This is Family Policy Matters. This program is produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a pro-family research and education organization dedicated to strengthening and preserving the family. And now from the studio, here's John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. It is our pleasure to have Wesley J. Smith with us on the program. Wesley is a lawyer and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. He is also a consultant to the Patients' Rights Council. In May 2004, the National Journal named him one of the nation's premier expert thinkers on bioengineering. He has also been named a great defender of life by Human Life Review for his work against the legalization of euthanasia. Wesley is the author or co-author of 13 books, and his Human Exceptionalism blog, which is hosted by National Review, is one of the premier blogs dealing with the dignity and life issues. Wesley is with us to talk about bioethics movement and some of the increasing threats to life that we are seeing in the United States and overseas. Wesley, it's great to have you with us on the program today.
Thanks very much, and hello to your listeners.
Well, thank you for your time. Now, you've been writing about the issues of life and human dignity for over 20 years. What inspired you to leave a successful legal practice and get involved in speaking out against what you have referred to as the culture of death in our society?
Well, actually, I'd left the legal practice before that and had become an author, and then I had a friend commit suicide under the influence of Hemlock Society literature. And my friend killed herself on her 76th birthday. She had leukemia, but it was treatable. She had some pain issues, but she wouldn't take her pain control. And after she had killed herself, I was so upset, and I thought something's really wrong here, that I asked her executrix to send me her personal files, which I knew she'd have because she was such an organized person. And in that file, I found Hemlock Society literature, which I hadn't heard of before, which was basically how to commit suicide, and we give you moral permission to do it. And so she had underlined the drugs to take, how to use a plastic bag to make sure she died, and so forth. And it was proselytizing for suicide. And I was so upset about this that I wrote a piece for Newsweek magazine in the My Turn section called The Whispers of Strangers. And in The Whispers of Strangers, the theme was, here her friends, Frances was her name, was depressed. We were trying to keep her in life, and here were these strangers telling her it's empowering to get out of life. That came out in June of 1983, and I received so much hate mail telling me euthanasia was the future, suicide was noble, you know, may you get cancer, this kind of thing. And remember, John, that's when you had to write a letter and put on a stamp. It wasn't email, so people had to work to send in the hate mail. I was so stunned, and I thought, what happened to my culture, and where was I when it happened? And that's when I took that turn and started moving against assisted suicide, and then I began to see the entire field in bioethics and how human life was being devalued in a utilitarian manner, and it changed my life completely, and this is where we are today.
Wow. Well, that's an amazing experience. I appreciate you sharing that with us, and one that obviously has affected you in very significant ways. Euthanasia is becoming increasingly accepted in some areas, especially overseas. It is legal in the Netherlands and in Belgium. For our listeners who might be unfamiliar with the term, what is euthanasia, and what can we learn about the dangers of euthanasia laws that have been approved in other countries?
Well, euthanasia is when typically, a doctor gives a lethal injection to a patient to supposedly end suffering. Assisted suicide, which we do have legal in this country in Oregon, Washington, and Vermont, is when the doctor, if it's doctor-assisted suicide, gives the patient a prescription to take a lethal overdose, knowing that's what the patient intends. As far as I'm concerned, in terms of the ethics of the thing, it's kind of, there's no difference. It's like the left leg and the right leg walking. They're the same thing ethically. And what you've seen in Europe shows what will happen if we follow that course here. Because once you define killing as an acceptable answer to human suffering, then areas of suffering that qualify for killing continually expand. There's no way not to, because it's logic. So in the Netherlands, for example, doctors have been allowed to do euthanasia first in a decriminalized way and now legally since 1972 from a court decision. And they've gone from killing terminally ill people who ask for it to chronically ill people who ask for it to disabled people who ask for it. Now they're killing people with mental illness. Psychiatrists write in journals about how liberating it is for mentally ill patients to get euthanasia. Old people are being euthanized because they're tired of life. Infants, even though it's technically still illegal to commit infanticide in the Netherlands, it is done openly. They've even published something called the Groningen Protocol. It's a bureaucratic checklist for committing infanticide. And in Belgium, what it took the Dutch 30 years to get to, the Belgians have jumped off head first off that same cliff with enthusiasm. In addition to the things I just described, in Belgium they're doing joint euthanasia killings of elderly couples if they don't want to be widowed. You've seen some terrible cases. A transsexual didn't like her sex change surgery and was so upset she went to be euthanized and was. You've had disabled people killed. They've just passed a law in Belgium where you can have child-assisted suicide, no age limit. And the Belgians, and now beginning the Dutch, they have joined euthanasia of disabled and mentally ill people with organ harvesting. It is a terrible fall off a deep vertical moral cliff, but it is the logic of the euthanasia movement.
Well, Wesley, I know you've been an outspoken critic also of the bioethics movement in particular. Bioethics sounds like a somewhat harmless enough term. What is this movement all about and why is it so dangerous?
Well, bioethics is short for biomedical ethics, and it shouldn't be dangerous except for the people who predominate in the what I call the mainstream bioethicists or the ones with the greatest influence. I mean, you'll have like bioethicists who don't agree with this kind of thing, but they'll always have a modifier in front of their name, such as a Catholic bioethicist or a conservative bioethicist. But most of the influential practitioners of this, such as Ezekiel Emanuel, who was very instrumental in helping to create Obamacare, others like Peter Singer, who some of your listeners might have heard of, they take a very utilitarian approach. That is, they have rejected the sanctity of human life, the equality of human life, in order to embrace what they call a quality of life ethic in healthcare. And that not only opens the door for many of them to things such as assisted suicide and euthanasia, but to healthcare rationing, to something called medical futility or futile care theory, where doctors are beginning to be permitted through bioethics committees and so forth to refuse wanted life-sustaining treatment based on their perception of the quality of life or the cost of the patient care. It all becomes about politics and who has the power.
Well, and this issue of end-of-life care really came to the nation's attention to a great degree last year in the United States with the suicide of 29-year-old Brittany Maynard in Oregon. And this was really a push by the Right to Die movement to bring this issue into the spotlight. Now, Brittany had been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer and chose to end her life under Oregon's Death with Dignity Act.
Look at the language they use, John.
Yes.
It's assisted suicide, but they don't want to call anything what it really is. Any movement that has to use euphemisms as the honey to help the hemlock go down, perhaps you better watch and worry about that movement. The Brittany Maynard case is a remarkable demonstration of the power of media bias and a big-time PR money. This is a project of Compassion and Choices, which used to be called, more honestly, the Hemlock Society. And think about this Brittany Maynard case. There have been more than 700 assisted suicides in Oregon since 1997. Not one of them made this kind of a splash. Not one, perhaps the first one, even really made any news. So why Brittany Maynard? Why suddenly is she declared to be one of the remarkable people of 2014 because she committed suicide? It's because you have a unholy coalition between these activists and media who like to have the if it bleeds, it leads kind of storyline. And of course, this is a tragic case. You had a very beautiful young woman with everything to live for suddenly stricken with brain cancer. But even if you see what she wrote, She did not try hospice because she assumed she'd have a worst case scenario in terms of dying. And then she wrote that she didn't want to have her family see her go through this kind of thing. She didn't want her husband to see her undergo a period of decline and death. Well, if that's, she was saying to quite a great degree, I'm going to put myself out of my husband's and my family's misery. This is a terrible thing to extol. If my wife, God forbid, came down with something like that, and she said, I want to kill myself so you don't have to take care of me for the rest of my life and experience this, I'd be really upset. I'd say, what do you think I'm here for? And I'm not criticizing her. I mean, you know, none of us knows what our own limits are. But a society that gives her boosts and puts her on the cover of People magazine for killing herself, whereas if she had decided that she was going to fight against the dying of the light or had gone into hospice to have the best quality of life she could for the time she had left, nobody would have heard of her. What does that tell us about where we're going as a culture?
What can individuals who value the sanctity of human life do to shine the light on issues like infanticide, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and all of these challenges that we face?
You know, some of your listeners might not like what I'm about to say, but I think they have to focus a little less on abortion and more on these issues. People know about abortion now. It's been a huge fight for many decades, and I'm not saying to stop doing it, but I do think that many pro-lifers get very caught up in this idea of innocent babies, and that's frankly easier to advocate on behalf of than some of these things like the value of an elderly woman in a nursing home or the value of somebody dying from AIDS. That's not as easy because abortion isn't really about us per se because we're born, right? We made it. But all of these other issues that I'm dealing with, they're very painful to deal with because they're a threat to us. They're scary. And that makes it harder for people to want to look at them. Secondly, I think pro-lifers have to be willing to work with people in coalition who may not be pro-life on abortion. For example, the disability rights community is very adamant against assisted suicide because they correctly perceive themselves as the targets. And sometimes pro-lifers are reluctant to work with people who don't agree with them on abortion, for example, the issue of assisted suicide. That's a mistake because pro-lifers, I don't think, by themselves are enough to stop this agenda. In coalition, they can. Every time we have successfully prevented assisted suicide from spreading in this society, it's because there has been a coalition of strange political bedfellows, people who disagreed about secularism and religious values and so forth, but did agree that assisted suicide must not be allowed. The latest example of that was Massachusetts. Now, you'd think that liberal Massachusetts would vote in assisted suicide. But because you had that kind of coalition in 2012, Massachusetts said no to legalizing assisted suicide. So there's still power in that kind of coalition, and it can be done if people are willing to work with those with whom they adamantly disagree on other issues.
Well, and that's such a key part of this in raising these issues and defending life is for people to get involved and engaged. And Wesley, unfortunately, we're just about out of time for this week, but where can people go to read the articles that you have published, find out about the books that you've written, and also follow you on social media?
Oh, well, thank you. My Twitter is @ForcedExit, ForcedExit, which was the name of my book Against Assisted Suicide, which is, of course, still available on Amazon and so forth. If you go to National Review Online, and there's a scroll of their blogs, the Human Exceptionalism blog is mine. If people want to go to patientsrightscouncil.org, patientsrightscouncil.org, that is the best resource for that particular issue and medical issues that I'm aware of, patientsrightscouncil.org.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing that. Wesley Smith, I want to thank you so much for your time, for being with us today on Family Policy Matters, and for your incredibly important work in defending the sanctity of human life.
Well, thanks for letting me present my views. I appreciate it.
Family Policy Matters is an information and analysis feature of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Join us weekly for discussion on policy issues affecting the family. If you have questions or comments, please contact us at 919-807-0800 or visit our website at ncfamily.org.